Welcome to the Signals Podcast, a monthly transmission of future frameworks for cross-cultural design. I am your host, Elia Vargas. To build a more inclusive, accessible, and global digital future, we need new frameworks for technological development. Every month, Signals broadcasts insights from visionaries at the forefront of creative inquiry and design innovation about how emerging technology can support cross-cultural connection. What do cultural production and co-creation look like today? What about in 2050? What does cultural exchange mean in the digital age? How do technocultures contribute to or corrode a shared global cultural exchange? How can the nascent technological domains of artificial intelligence, extended reality, big data, and Web3 contribute positively to the planet? Can technocultural exchange tackle the pressing crises of climate change, xenophobia, assault on women's rights, and the crisis of imagination facing the world today? From the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond, these are some of the questions we will tackle. The initiative Sea Change is implemented by the Goethe Institute San Francisco in cooperation with Gray Area and funded by the Foreign Office of the Federal Republic of Germany. My guest today is Christina Stenbrecker-Fant, co-founder and CEO of Blockchain.art. Christina, I completely failed to ask you if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, and I'm sorry for doing that. I hope I did it justice. Welcome to Signals. How are you?
Hi, I'm absolutely excited to be part of the podcast and start the conversation with you. And Steinbrecher-Pfand is pretty much a tongue breaker, so I appreciate any version of it by now, so all fine, all cool. Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course, and yes, I clearly got it completely wrong. I'm sorry for that. You wrote a couple years ago an article in Medium that introduced blockchain.art, and you said, the art market achieved $68 billion in sales in 2018. And is considered, quote, the last unregulated financial market. It is also one of the last industries that has yet to be meaningfully disrupted, and you have disrupted in quotes, by tech. I don't want to disrupt the art market. I want to improve it. Now we have the technology to do so. I believe the solution resides at the intersection of NFTs and the blockchain platform Ethereum. What is blockchain.art?
I wrote this article basically at a place and time where I just came and was still running art fairs, international art fairs for 10 years. And I started coming to San Francisco regularly in 2018, where I got into the blockchain space. Quite frankly, it was the meetup. It was the hot topic of meetups. And meetup app was big. And so I really got into blockchain technology, trying to understand what does it mean. And I'm a specialist in the arts. I'm like, this is absolutely fantastic. This is what we need. This is what our digital artists need. Blockchain.art is an application, is a tool for industry participants, from the artist, collector, and the gallery to buy and sell NFTs, where we made it the first, the logic was not to exclude anyone. Yeah, not to say we don't need the middleman, but really look at NFTs and blockchain as a tool. Yeah, so I'm coming from this where you sell physical work, where you have different media, and where it became strongly more day-to-day operation to sell, for example, prints, lithographies online, books, catalogs. I'm like, fantastic. Finally, we can sell digital art, and it can be done very efficient. And so my own personal sort of geography obviously played in. I'm very much interested in the fringes of art production, right? Of the global geographical fringes. And I'm like, fantastic, finally. In an ideal world, everyone would be able to participate.
I want to ask you how blockchain.art works, how it operates, and how it operates for artists, for galleries, and for collectors. But maybe first, since that was 3 years ago now, I suppose, how is that going? How do you feel about that notion of equity and its functionality as a tool?
I think we have to sort of just quickly separate between sort of the technical aspect of it and then sort of the larger meanings of society and how it is like now discussed. So as I'm coming from the art fair, meaning an art fair is this big system of art transactions, right? Where you set up an infrastructure where galleries join or intermediaries, people that represent artists join to sell work. And this is what we went for with blockchain.art. So in the first instance, it is for galleries, intermediaries, call them newspeak influencers, right? So I went with the word even influencers because I was fundraising and venture capital couldn't wrap their heads around a gallery. For them, a gallery was this space at the corner of the street that is sort of dusty. It had this dusty connotation. And so I went then explaining it with the word influencer, modern influencers, people that represent something. It can be as well curators. So they get invited, they apply or they get invited. They fill out a short questionnaire. Then a colleague and me, a curatorial colleague and me, we look at the work. They sort of put in an application and they basically show work that they want to list, they want to sell. And in sort of our flow, it's the gallery or the intermediary who's driving it. So the gallery says, I want to represent, or I'm working already with this artist and we want to do this NFT sale. And the gallery is taken through a bunch of flows where they fill out just basically digital blanks and in an application. They send basically whatever they filled in to the artist approves, edits, or declines, or makes comments, and then basically mints the work, as pre-minting, is uploading it, and then the gallery gets the links, uses the link, either shares it on their website, on their webpage, or does it within our marketplace. And this is the logic, but you were quoting me now on my paper, on my Medium article on Ethereum, but we basically went to Polkadot. Yeah, so we are in the Polkadot ecosystem. When I wrote it, Ethereum seemed to be the easiest way, but then due to basically the connotations and takeaways of an eco-friendly solution or carbon neutral positive way, we looked at the proof of stake versions and then went on Polkadot. So this is how it works. And this was basically my logic that you understand. It was my logic of the coming from the art industry where intermediaries were driving, this was their task to sell, to help artists to sell, create a context for the work for them with regard, you can say, marketing, promotion, PR, to basically tell the story of this artist, yeah, and do that and act as a multiplier. So this is how it works. So on the technical end of it.
Thank you for that. I do have, we're not going to get to them right now, but I'll be curious to ask you about these distinctions between proof of stake versus proof of work protocols and the very fast moving, I almost want to call it history, but maybe development is the better word, of attentiveness to the energy footprint of blockchain and NFTs in general. That conversation has kind of skyrocketed, I think, as you kind of alluded to. You outlined this a little bit, and I'm really excited to be talking with you right now because I both want to learn more about the possibilities and potential of what blockchain technology can be, kind of as a bigger cultural conversation or techno-cultural conversation. But I'm also super attentive to the way that this is functioning to serve a very, I don't want to say very specific or hyper-specific, because the need for a perhaps decentralized transaction platform for digital art has been a very long conversation in the history of digital art and its relationship to fine art. I'm curious to know a little bit more first why you decided to make this transition. Like, why go from the fine art market, from a pretty fantastic position and vantage point, I believe most recently as the executive director of the Vienna Contemporary International Art Fair. Why did you move from that into the startup world, into developing blockchain technology?
I've been basically working my entire career trajectory through all the possible jobs in the art world, right? And you and I myself, originally, I'm from Central Asia. I'm from Kazakhstan. And but I worked in various centers, right? So I got to work in London, I worked in Moscow, I worked in Vienna. And over the entire time, and I'm sort of my heart and mind, my heart is still in Central Asia, right? So my heart to some degree is in Central Asia, and I have a lot of friends and artist friends there. And so you join, obviously, you sort of brainstorm as like, how can we improve the situation for showing knowledge about, and you ultimately do not only think about your area, right? It becomes this conversation about everyone who is not in the center. Yeah. So you join sort of forces where you think about like how, what can be done. And then it's not only, but you're not the driver. The ultimate driver is the artist, right? So they are reaching out, not to you, but basically they're looking for this conversation. And over the years, I basically did a project that was called The Museum in 2000. I started that in 2009, 10, 11. And I did basically and I was working between Berlin and Moscow at the time. And my thoughts were, it's like, how can we do shows? How can we show artists? And everything came down to expensive logistics. It's like, you can't do a show. It's expensive to ship. The insurance costs are sort of killing us. And you're like, but this can't be the end of the conversation, right? This just cannot be the end. But we have, and then obviously artists have been making digital work as well, right? And you're like, can we just show digital? Can we show video, sound, animation? And this became like my stick, right? I was constantly thinking, how can we move borders in an efficient way? Like, how can we actually get art to be shown? And maybe, so I felt always when it's like people were showing me catalogs of things, like, this is the show I did. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I love books, but I felt this is like a graveyard of shows. And I felt like art has to be seen and shown, right? It cannot just stay on a bookshelf. It has to move. It has to move people. And then I've been doing these V Museum shows where I was showing digital work constantly. But it's sort of, you know, oh, that's interesting, but it's difficult to only show digital work in a space, yada, yada, and so on. And then when I was doing art fairs, and if you're a good art fair director, some people come and start. And at some point you understand your job isn't to not only promote your fair, have a great relationship with your clients, but your ultimate client is the artist. And if you are responsible for sort of a geography, and Vienna Contemporary, we did sort of Central Europe and Eastern Europe, and we were the focus points, and this is how sort of the branding, and we were doing everything humanly possible to get the best work. And the artists have to be enticed and excited to do good work, right? To good work, to give their representatives amazing work. And so I did studio visits, and the artists would always show me work. And then they would go like, yeah, and I have this sound work and I have this video. But the gallerist, they say it's difficult to show it at a fair because, you know, it's also expensive, square meter. Again, same conversation. And this just kept chewing on me, right? As a constant, like, what can we do? And I don't know if you remember, around 2010, there was a lot of thought and space was given to new media art, right? It was like around the museums, there was like, how do you curate it? How do you collect it? How do you exhibit it? But the number of shows of digital art was still very low, and is still, right? So when COVID hit, we saw that the museums were not ready, most of them didn't even have enough work to do any digital, and not even talking about the contracts they made with the artist of actually not being able to show it online. But that's like a different conversation. But this kept going with me, right? Because the transportation costs just became higher, right? And so the risk, and so like you have the museums and the galleries, they have the local people versus like, and every gallerist, I love gallerists and curators, like they are intrinsically curious people. Yeah, they might not be able or like feel like they can't teach, but they have always one sort of particular interest, and they would love to give that artist a chance, but it's like, doesn't work. And so I came into this blockchain conversation, and I'm like, this might do in the first instance be the solution, right? It's a tool. It's a real tool. People are fine selling books, prints, work online. It's fine. It works. So let's do the same for digital. And my hypothesis was also that intermediaries, so the logic was always, if you have a gallery that represents you, they will also have to give you a space in the space, right? A show in the space, in the physical space. And but with digital art, it's not necessary. It's not necessary that it has to. They can give you just a digital show, and it's so valuable to be able to do so. And I've been following dealers. I've saw what they've been sort of eyeing on artists that are natively digital, artists that are, as I said, on the geographical sort of fringes that are not in the focus of attention, right? But I've seen galleries talking about that, engaging with artists. So, but it wasn't sort of fitting the program, whatever the argument there, right? And I'm like, this is fantastic. This can do that, and finally we'll be able to have this conversation, to have this dialogue and have this exchange. And this has been a driver for many years. Yeah. And I really looked, and then you can have a conversation about centralized versus decentralized, whether galleries are needed. And I have a lot to say about that. But generally my approach was, this is a technical tool. And of course, where else should we be going other than a seamless, borderless exchange of content, assets, art, right? Where else should it be going? And yes, this is my ultimate interest, and I want to be part of this driver. And this is what still highly motivates me, because I don't see that alive to that degree as as the people that came together and I had conversations with the Super Rare founders, with Dapper Labs, and with OpenSea, where we early days sort of had conversations in the Bay Area, had calls, and everyone came with sort of their own baggage to the conversation, right? So everyone had their own motivation to do so, right? And I came from this legacy of art, right? And from this, I've seen these stack of problems that artists have been spending years trying to get into this conversation, right? Digital artists, generative artists, native digital artists, sound artists have been always saying to the fine art world, come to me, come to my studio, have a conversation with me. And they're like, this is interesting, but I cannot really I cannot sell it. I don't see. And this is true, right? For when I started to pitch in 2019 to anyone, and I'm going to stop there because I'm talking for a long time. You can ask me more specific questions. On either end, on the art end, everyone's like, we've been trying to sell digital art for the last 30 years. And I mean digital art, not only visual, but the digital where it's a digital file. And on the other end, the VCs were like, show me the year over year or month over month growth of digital art. And there was not even in the reporting of auction results or gallery, there was digital art was not present. It was just not there. And then also on the VC end, it's like, digital assets, wants digital assets, right? So it was this sort of conversations early on.
It's interesting the kind of simultaneous correlation between the broader interest in new media art and technology, and which kind of, you know, we think of in a linear sense, which I'm not that interested in progress narratives myself in terms of how I think. But there's like this future facing new media art. And at the same time, there's been an extraordinary uptake in the interest in media archaeology, which kind of moves in the opposite direction because of a lot of the things that you're talking about, the museums, trying to figure out what it means to archive, collect, and store, not just digital files, but also archaic hardware as well, and what that kind of looks like. I really like what you're saying about moving towards a borderless model. Prior to the pandemic, I was living in a Pan-African context in Ghana, Ethiopia, and Uganda, having different conversations with media artists in that context produced such a different way of thinking about how data essentially is exchanged, both on an infrastructure level, also on a governmental regulatory level, what people have access to, what kind of censorship is in place. Uganda has a social media tax when you buy a phone, you have to pay this social media tax or else your phone will not be able to use social media websites. And I didn't even really know, I wasn't in a position to know what that even meant in a infrastructural architecture sense, but these are not trivial matters in the sense of capitalizing on what internet culture truly offers in this respect, in terms of global exchange. And in conversations with the Goethe Institute about what global exchange looks like, and particularly from the perspective of a Central European state-funded institution, how to talk about certain things that they're operating in countries where there are censorship laws and you cannot necessarily have conversations around certain types of cultural exchange, for instance. Coming from the global north, it's difficult to understand the ways that infrastructure really impacts what kinds of conversations are even plausible, and therefore what kind of tools are being used. In northern Ghana, where I was living, people were making, they called them village films, with their phones. And they were these rich, deep tribal mythologies that were being repurposed into kind of almost like reality TV sitcoms in a certain way. I mean, it was really clashing together these, what we think of in the very basic binary sense of like traditional and modernist realities in pretty magical ways. And perhaps blockchain opens up the plausibility of there being a bigger global market for such types of, I don't dare I say like commodities, because I think in your context, that's actually like, it's important that art is thought of in a commodity in this context, in the way that the tool is operating.
This is exactly the conversation, exactly about the commodity and infrastructure, right? If you look, the thing that resonated, so the argument or the fact that resonates with everyone, no matter where you are on the spectrum, and sort of there was a lot of NFT hate, so to speak, right? It was like even coined this NFT hate. But what was a major takeaway everywhere was that artists can make a royalty. Yeah. And that fact as an infrastructure has big impacts all globally, right? So if implemented, it has a huge impact. Whether it has a life-changing impact or a positive impact, but it has a positive impact. Like it's not like net zero, but it has a positive impact depending on transaction and transaction of commodity, right? So this fact is higher than zero in most cases, in all cases, basically, right? So it has, that's something that couldn't be installed in simple technology prior, right? So it needed like a centralized something where you buy and then you go back and resell there. But here, also the creator and artist can set up the contract, can set up the royalty, and sort of give their brainchild a goodbye kiss, and then off it goes, the brainchild, the commodity or the artwork, and then it does what it does, yeah? And then we can speak about how it was misused, how sort of scams came up. Anyway, but technically, it's possible, right? So that if you look at it, and this is what I'm always trying to try it also in the year 21, that was always difficult to say, like, let's not talk about what the financial markets are doing right now. Like, not like, let's just forget of the sound of potential USD coming in, you know, like, that was the only media. This what I mean with noise. But let's go back and think about what technology, what blockchain does. And no matter where the artists were standing, and there is a lot of artists that are highly, highly critical, and rightfully so, right? So we've seen an absolute takedown of crypto right now, right? Have been critical of the speculative aspect and of the risks that are associated with it. But the possibility that you actually can secure a royalty, which means it's plus more than zero, which means eventually it can lead to securing your life and where across the globe, also for physical, right? It's a question then of enforcing, but that led also to artists actually have a sit down with whoever and say, can we not do that for physical work as well? Right. And to say, I mean, it's a thing, it's a certificate. Let's attach that certificate to a work of art. And going forward, if you don't own the certificate, then you cannot, like, then your artwork that you own physically is not worth much, right? Can we like make that as well? It's of course very costly, and it needs like, how do you enforce it even, right? So how do you really enforce it? But I'm just saying the technical, from the infrastructure point, and this is where you're coming from, right? When you say Ghana and look at the commodity, this can be done. It needs incentives. Who is doing that, right? So who is incentivized enough? And this is when we're saying we are coming from the global north, when we speak also about the physical world, what of the structures aren't incentivized enough to actually set up the structure for it? Yeah. And that's even a different conversation that I was trying to have recently in New York. It's like, hey guys, auction houses, whoever, who's taking that on for the whole aspect, for the whole thing, right? That the whole industry will have to push more on behalf of the artist, quite honestly, because it's like, but it works anyway, doesn't it? Sort of that's the argument I was getting. But here, I think over the years, the voice of the artist will have to be heard better, as I see. But this is again about what is the basic element, what is the ultimate takeaway from what blockchain technology can do to benefit the person creating, whether a commodity, a unique work, or a multiple of something. And I think that's absolutely, that will keep a lot of people still busy. It's not solved yet. It was just a quick window looking at this is actually possible.
Yeah, that question of speed and acceleration in society in general, we're talking about a span of just a couple years as though there is a finalized entity, be it digital or physical, that can be put out into the world. Obviously, NFTs exist, crypto art exists, cryptocurrencies exist, but the idea of blockchain as a technology that continues to change is and respond to the circumstances that society asks of it too is an ongoing thing. What you've been describing makes me think of, and it's funny to quote something from blockchain.art's executive summary, but I enjoyed reading that document. Blockchain.art is in a beta model right now. So I assume you would think of it as in its infancy. And so reading the executive summary is a useful place to glean ideas about it. In the executive summary, you quote Casey Reyes, who's an artist and also the creator of the programming language Processing, who says, the blockchain is the key to moving away from licenses toward property for digital media. That's kind of what you're talking about, I think, right? Like if Casey is talking about this as the potential, that seems extraordinarily powerful. And it's complicated, I guess, too, for all the reasons that you've already described a little bit, because that inherently raises the question of like, does art need value to be valued? But here's where I understand kind of the particular area in which you are developing this as a tool for. I mean, in the context that you are operating, it seems to be such a clear solution.
Yeah. So the question, does art need value to... So, and that's an interesting one. So, I mean, that we can fill, I guess, hours with that. And that's not a question that I'm trying to answer, right? So this is not even... And this is... What happened last year, we didn't see it coming, right? We didn't see that coming in that version. All of us, I'd say. You must understand, so I'm talking, there is the cryptocurrency conversation, and I'm not part of the cryptocurrency conversation, right? I'm following it. But I'm looking at myself and I'm really much regarding myself as a specialist in the art infrastructure and technology end, right? And I know of the pain points and I know what it can sort of do. And I was trying to bring that together. What happened, obviously, is that the cryptocurrency conversation took over. Yeah, but how it's related, but I'll park it here. And as transactions on blockchain do happen, we then did transfers completely via Stripe, right? We completely, to some degree, disconnected from the crypto conversation because everything that is done on the platform was done through Stripe and through USD. But the transactions on chain have to be paid for in crypto. So but since Polkadot, the Polkadot network is different to Ethereum, the transactions were sort of neglectable in terms of price. So it didn't play a role on the general price of the work. That put aside, what happened, obviously, that crypto had many different functions or reasons, basically experienced this incredible growth in value that took, let's say, the very specialized conversation that we were sort of having in a complete different direction. At some point, and so there were obviously during the pandemic, the Clubhouse spaces, the Twitter spaces, Instagram conversations about this. And a lot of people, and now you're reading basically of the disappointment of the same people that entered and then were invited to the space, let's say the most neutral term, by whoever they've been following, either business influencers, whoever in this crypto space. And they felt they could gain. And at the same time, it became, let's say, a defining conversation for many people that joined the space that didn't do all of these steps and they couldn't have done, right? They joined the conversation when it was already sort of blooming, the cryptocurrency space, and they were defending it with knives and forks, their space, right? And they were defending the fortitude that they have been experiencing at this time, meaning this was the window to actually create wealth fast in a society that doesn't have that mobility anymore. And in many ways, very detailed and professional, like sort of conversations, they couldn't happen in the same space, right? So that it was too broad of a spectrum to actually talk about a thing. The excitement was too big and was carried away. I have to say, I have all the respect for that as well, because I understand the reasoning for it. And now we see what happened, right? Many people have lost a lot of wealth. People that gained it, were putting a lot of hope to it, lost. So now we continue basically having that very specific, specialized conversation, but post or during this breakdown, which is very unfortunate, I have to tell you, right? Which is very unfortunate.
I appreciate the sensitivity that you give to those distinctions. And I can imagine how hard it is to have the particular conversation that you are developing, that you are on the forefront of developing, while there's this public shouting coming from these different spaces that are not unjustified, but maybe are also attaching onto some sort of public sentiment that is not going to be attentive to what is a technology that's clearly going to be around and clearly has transformative potential towards democratizing practices, financial transactions, borderless circumstances, and the need to have that conversation.
So I think this was my sort of my explanation. So, and I had to bring it up because this was the question. It's like, is art only valuable if it has a value? And over the course of last year, this was definitely where the conversation was taken. And we're defending it vastly, right? So anyone, because obviously people joined, made NFTs, and then you can there were corrupt schemes, why they got that much attention and so on and so on. But this was celebrated this was the hubris of that momentum, right? And now it's sort of gone to a big extent. But there was no conversation. There was no space, no mental, no public space to actually take the conversation somewhere else. And I have to acknowledge that, right? Because it was something else was going on. And now we're basically taking the conversation again further. And we have to acknowledge that. And that's why I'm saying I had conversations with galleries, museums, collectors, curators that felt they were looking at like, is everything that I've done till now obsolete? And all of a sudden, within 2 months, there was a perception that there's like the set of rules that you have to follow, that this is the rules, these are the rules. And this was, of course, it was defended. These rules were defended by many people in this space that created them. It was doing well for them. And they created these rules. And this was an interesting learning for me or observation, because I came from the fine art industry where there were perceived rules, right? So there were sort of perceived rules. This is how it happened. And then I entered the blockchain conversation where everyone's like, we don't have rules. We're just making. And then all of a sudden, everyone was celebrating rules that came out of thin air. And not only celebrating, defending them with their lively good, so to say, right? Everyone's like, but this is the way. It has to be Ethereum. It has to be 10,000 characters. This is how it goes. You do the auction. If you don't do an auction, not going to talk to you. This is not hot. Da, 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 yeah. So they have to look left and they can't look right. And all of a sudden, and this was, of course, very interesting, too, very recently, even curators from the art got confused, because there were, of course, a number of artists that were artists and did a quick spin and did an NFT, and they were doing great, right? And they were sort of doing this rules. And they're like, it worked for me. All of a sudden, I'm sort of less stressing about the future of my livelihood. I feel like if this continues, this is amazing. This all got sort of intertwined and interconnected. So all of a sudden, these were these rules. And you must understand, so my platform is on Polkadot, is in the Polkadot ecosystem. And it turned to, well, that's the rules now. That's Ethereum. And I understood there was very little space to claim the opposite, so to speak. I did go into the conversation and I gave a sober account of the situation, but this was the livelihood. This was the final, like, people did defend it with their livelihood, meaning they made this made them more secure of their future. And especially in the artistic community that are fighting sort of to make a livelihood, being able to take that sorrow away means a lot. So this was a significant and for me very fascinating conversation, sort of, right? All of a sudden there were all these rules and now they're gone again.
In the Bay Area about 10 or 15 years ago, there was this crazy conflict between cyclists and butterfly scientists, because some of the bike pathways going down, I think it was Market Street in San Francisco, mm-hmm. happened to be a spot on the migrational pattern of either monarch butterflies or some other relatively rare butterfly, because of the bird's eye view of the topography of San Francisco, okay. happened to resemble part of their ancient flight patterns. Mm-hmm. And so you had this terrible scenario where you had ecologists and cyclists like arguing with each other. And it strikes me as a not unsimilar scenario here, where you have generally people who are like, you have artists fighting with environmentalists, fighting like critical technologists fighting with humanities individuals. Like, I would, while I recognize and am part of my own big, you know, like, we love to get so hyper specialized in the modern world that like anybody could be an enemy and one must stake their claims in certain ways. It's so hard to like pull away sometimes and recognize that like some of this is okay, some of it's not. Like, we're maybe the vitriol of the conversation is a bit unrealistic with comparison to the kind of solutions that are trying to be created. And I guess obviously, like, when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars and venture capital and whatnot, maybe there is a sense that there isn't honesty coming to the table. And that's probably a basic requirement for any kind of productive dialogue, is a sense of integrity. But, you know, this is a moment where I want to ask you, rather than like dwelling on some of these, the sort of pitfalls that have come along in the last couple of years. I mean, you mentioned the Polkadot blockchain network and its distinction from Ethereum. Ethereum is a proof of work blockchain. Polkadot is a proof of stake blockchain. Can you describe those differences a little bit? They have ecological, energetic implications, among other things. And then after that, maybe explain a little bit what, like, we're talking about the current moment of what's happening with blockchain. I'm sure you have quite a future horizon of what you can imagine blockchain, both blockchain.art, but also blockchain technology in general doing.
Absolutely. So for me, it was then when I was sitting at the table and sort of had to make the decision, for me, it's like, okay, proof of work versus proof of stake. And this is sort of the base, is how much energy is used in order to mint, to do a record on chain. That's the basic, like, the, to do a record recording on chain, how much energy is used. And there are studies, of course, but the approximate, you can say that proof of work is using 95% more energy than a proof of stake entry. And that is a huge advantage of proof of stake. Yeah. And that's why that was sort of course, it's a no-brainer, right? It's sort of a no-brainer. This is why we chose the proof of stake. Ethereum, why it got so popular, Ethereum and Bitcoin were the early mass popular promoted known blockchains where people bought early coins from. Yeah, so people, so as Bitcoin and then a little bit later Ethereum, people bought. So it, when actually during the pandemic, Bitcoin and Ethereum had this increase in price, this is when it came actually to play. And the other blockchains that followed were sort of the later stage chains where, let's say, technologists got really excited about the capabilities, what you can do with the chains. And here we can go sort of fairly deep on Polkadot. You can basically run your own chain, right? When Ethereum, you build on top of that chain, and on Polkadot, even industries or can build their own chain and maintain their chain. It's a lot easier. And then they talk to each other. So basically different applications and different chains within the Polkadot ecosystem then talk to each other. And this is as such not possible for Ethereum. It has a certain capacity that it cannot extend. Ethereum is saying basically they're working on a proof of stake version. It's not easy. They acknowledge it's not easy, and they're saying sort of, but anyway, this is the status quo. And we went for that because we thought it's a no-brainer, which I still think is a non-brainer. But of course, with now 2022 coming around, February 24 coming around with the war in Ukraine, and now if you talk about the North, the European North, is everything the day starts with a conversation about energy, and the day ends with the conversation with energy, meaning about the war and the human tragedy and that. But then, and this is, you can help that to some degree, right? And sort of everyone is putting pressure on that, yes. But then what you cannot help if you're being completely cut off the energy supply for, in the case of the North, to anything between 60% to 20% of the annual energy supply for a certain state in Europe. And that is, so right now, all over Europe, different plans are in place how to save energy over summer. And then basically, what, how does the scenario look like if Russia cuts off the one pipeline altogether? It's now in maintenance. So yes, all the eyes and all startup power and governmental energy and mental power is exercised. How can we look into different energies? How can we bring down energy consumption? And that's number one challenge for the next years to come till that nut is cracked. And not only in Europe, of course, but the same counts for the US. If you look at energy prices, I mean, they're coming slightly down, but still the barrel is incredibly expensive in comparison, and inflation is surging, and et cetera, et cetera. So yes, the conversation about energy is brought by political, geopolitical forces as a one topic in the society, and it's not, no one can brush it away. There's like, there's no way to say like, oh, well, but this is the market. The market is driving us to Ethereum, or is driving us somewhere. It's in the middle, it landed in the middle of society, and everyone is forced to take action. Not only a critical conversation, but is forced to take action. And I'll tell you, so many, many museums or institutions in the art sector did sort of wait it out. They were very excited about and the curators and together with artists were very excited about the possibility of NFT. But for them, it was like, let's wait out what's going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. We don't want to go into blockchains that are proof of work. That was a decision. That was a decision that was made. But we don't feel like we will wait what's going to happen. And this is now sort of also part of the conversations about digital and sort of tools for digital all over, I'd say.
We have just a couple minutes left, so I'm going to kind of make a right turn in asking you about specific questions and ask you a kind of broader question, which is a question that I ask all of our guests, which is, what is a question that you would ask to a guest on this program? And let me share why I think that's an important question. You know, again, pulling out, I mean, we've been having such a specific conversation for the last 50 plus minutes, and that is the case throughout the Signals podcast series. Each person is an expert artist, etc., in their own area. And so that's kind of the bigger picture, right? Is we're trying to draw together these disparate conversations to ask meaningful, critical questions about technocultures. And so as an expert in crypto art within the fine art context and creating the blockchain.art platform, what do you think is an important question to ask other experts thinking about technocultures?
I think, especially in the light of 2021, where the ultimate conversation was money, monetary value, right? And I'm very, and this was not for me, but the market defined it. So everything, every conversation was like, wow, this is. So my question would be for any other, like, does each of the participants define success for them, right? So because this is what, how does success look like in whatever you do or whatever you strive to do? And I would be interested to hear the answer to that.
Great, thank you. And let me, we'll end now by me asking you the question that my last guest, Dorothy Santos, who is an artist and educator and writer, and is also the executive director of the Processing Foundation at the current moment. Dorothy asked, are we allowed to forget in the future? What and how might we think about that function of forgetting in human cognition and in applying it to our daily lives?
That's a good one. Forgetting. I'm from a German minority in the Soviet Union that was then educated in Germany. So my cultural context doesn't allow me to forget. Yeah. And there is, rather than making cases why something can be forgotten, I activate going back and opening up painful conversations rather than trying to forget those. And I think I understand why the question, and I understand why GDP will grow when some things are forgotten. Yeah, so it's like I understand the take, but I believe in the opposite. I believe that we still have too many open flames or sort of things that are still under the rug. And the longer I am in the West, the longer I feel there's still things that I believed are not under the rug, are still under the rug. I would rather emphasize not forgetting and not allowing to forget. I believe in an active culture of not forget. Though I understand the question, but it doesn't, my historical context doesn't allow forgetting.
Something I deeply appreciate in the uniqueness of that question being asked to you is how you linked it to something that is not part of, say, digital culture or even a technology whatsoever. I mean, we might debate what technology is, but that answer you gave grounds us in bodies and places and physicality, along with the bits and wires and clouds that kind of operate our screen space, etc.
So I can maybe give you an example of the sort of the, without the cultural context, but even the work context. So when I was doing my alpha version, which is a very simple version of my product, and I was testing it. So when I was testing it with artists, what do you think was my main pain point? What I thought, this is going to be an issue with artists, was basically, and this is where forgetting comes in, where technological people were like, that's the future, da 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 da. I'm like, I had the sort of the biggest stomach ache I had about explaining to artists that when they do an NFT, when they basically sell or mint or upload a digital file, that in the user context, they will have little or no say about how their digital work will be exhibited. Yeah. And that was me of this coming, obviously, of that traditional system where the digital artist, when exhibited in a gallery or museum, would, when producing a digital work, film, whatever, would define very narrow how, what sort of screen, what sort of projector, everything was defined by the artist. And I'm like, I had to say, well, you know, it's got to be seen on that screen. And then the client, your buyer, you can do, you can give your advice on how you think it should be, but you really have no, like, say, quite honestly. Yeah. And that was my biggest stomach ache. Technologists on the developing end, it's like, why is that even a problem? They're selling something. That's fantastic, isn't it? So I was very much encouraged to forget my past and basically not even mention it that, like, that strongly, right? So it's like, you know it, but, like, they will figure it out, and then we'll deal with the problem when we have a problem, but it shouldn't be a problem. So about forgetting in this process. But, and I pointed it out, and sort of in the course of 2021, no one seemed to care, right? No one seemed to care. All the design studios, like, there was no indication, like, how do you exhibit a boar ape? Yeah, no one was even, like, thinking. There was no thought of that design studio that would play actually any relevant in the conversation. And obviously I'm talking then now 2022, where many people have left the space, and actually the sort of the specialized conversation is back. So you cannot forget that topic, and artists are back and actually having a say and having a thought around how can they help people enjoy it to a degree where it's not fleeting, but it's actually an asset that belongs to their home, to their collection, and to make that timestamp to actually think about that. Something that we were urged to forget or not make a point about. So I'd say in my even lived experience, forgetting goes in circles.
It surely does. You know, I suspect I could chat with you all day long. We've even gone over time a little bit, which on the context of a podcast clearly doesn't matter. Perhaps we should forget the cycles of broadcast, commercial, normal circumstances of the 1970s in television. Christina, thank you so much. Thanks for taking this time for elucidating this really complex relationship to blockchain technology and your work in an art context. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much, and hope to see you in person sometime soon.
To everyone who's listening, you can learn more by visiting blockchain.art. That is the URL for the platform. There's quite a wealth of information, and you can look at artists' work in the marketplace of the platform as well. Once again, my name is Elijah Vargas. The Signals Podcast is a project by the Goethe Institute in collaboration with Gray Area and the Sea Change Initiative. Signals is a monthly podcast released with the Signals digital magazine at seachange.xyz/signals. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Christina. Until next time.